Hi, this is Damon Pastolka, host of The Faces of Business, where I talk with interesting people sharing life and business experiences to entertain, engage, build community, and provide information to help others succeed. If you're interested in learning more about one of our guests or how we are helping business owners generate wealth and build businesses they can sell or succeed at Exit Your Way, you can find more information on our website, exityourway.com. Or by contacting me directly, Damon@exityourway.com. I hope you enjoy the show. All right, everyone. Welcome once again to The Faces of Business. I am your host, Damon Pastolka, and I am so excited today because we're going to be talking to none other than Mike Blake. If you look at the screen there, it says Mike Unblakeable. We're going to have to ask about that, but Mike from High Score Strategies. Mike is an expert in helping people gauge risk in buying and selling companies and business risk in general. Thanks for being here today, Mike.
Damon, thanks a lot. I'm going to have a lot of fun the next 45 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's going to be great. It's going to be great, man. So we always like to start off, Mike, with you probably didn't come out of school thinking that you are going to be helping people quantify risk in business. So how did you get here today to doing what you're doing?
So I have an interesting origin story. I'm a recovering venture capitalist and investment banker. I like being in venture capital, but I sucked at it. I was good at investment banking, but I hated doing it. And so over time, valuation sort of presented itself as a happy middle ground. And sort of the interesting part of the valuation story, you talk about nobody, I didn't necessarily grow up thinking I would do what I was going to do. Well, in fact, I could have, because my father ran the valuation practice for E&Y North America for about 25 years.
Whoa.
Until Sarbanes-Oxley killed his practice overnight. And he had to leave the firm basically to survive. So you can attribute this to chest beating if you want, but my father was, until he retired, he was a LeBron James of business valuation. Okay. His clients were the New England Patriots. They were Parmalat. He was an expert witness on the stand for 8 days in the wake of Enron.
Oh my goodness.
And for the longest time, I didn't want to do what he did because I'd always be my dad's kid. And nobody knows about him because he didn't write books or anything like that. He had no interest in the academic part. He just liked to go out there and basically kick people's asses. Yeah. But he was had no interest in being a teacher, that sort of thing. But I didn't want to be my dad's kid. But what I came to understand over the years was that being in the valuation space is the only thing that I'm reasonably good at that I can make a good legal living at doing.
I love it. I love it. You figured it out at least.
And so I fell into it because my wife applied for a job on my behalf without my knowledge. I got this interview out of nowhere, the firm in Atlanta called Adams Capital. And next thing you know, 2 months later, I'm working for them. I'm starting a career in the exact thing that I didn't think I'd be doing for the right, you know, with my life. But 20 years later, here I am.
Yeah. So as you started out, so let's talk a little bit. You said you really like venture capital, being a venture capitalist, but you sucked at it. So what did you really like about venture capital?
What I like about venture capital is it's one of the areas in finance where you're building something. Whereas much of corporate finance, and this is not a criticism, by the way, it's necessary for the function of our economy.
Yeah.
But most of corporate finance involves moving assets around, okay? And then people taking, you know, a commission off of the work that is required to move those assets from point A to point B to point C. Being involved in transactions where the profit margin is 1/100 of a percent, right? Like in currency transactions, something like that.
Yeah.
And that's just not something that interested me. What interested me in venture capital was building new businesses, right? Capitalizing mm-hmm. brand new concerns. How does that, you know, how does that work? And I got my start in that working in Belarus and Ukraine, of all places, for about 4 years, where I ran a privatization program over there after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And part of a big component of that was basically carrying the briefcases of venture capitalists who came over to evaluate the companies that we were putting through the program, and in some cases investing in them. Mm-hmm. And I learned a ton about venture capital by just being around people talking about deals, right?
Yeah.
And a better education, I could not have gotten a better education about that in any school in the planet. So I enjoyed it. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that facet of it. But at that age, I was not mature enough to distinguish good opportunities from bad opportunities.
It's funny you say that, because I think of my career, I had no idea how to do it early in my career. And now it seems like it's just, we're just a tad bit more discerning, ask those two or three questions that are the ones that you didn't ask before that would just hold you in the end if you didn't. Yeah, cool.
That's right. So much of it is about asking the right questions, right? So,
yeah.
As a 20 something, you know, it felt great. Everybody was kissing my ring because they wanted me to be the conduit to the general partner that would write the check. So yeah. Now I'm puffing my chest out and I feel like I'm all that. But at the end of the day, I just didn't know anything about anything. I wanted to be everybody's best friend. I wanted to fund everything. And that, you know, that's a great way to lose all of your money.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to say no in venture capital. That's for sure.
Yeah. Most of the time, right? Your job is to say no. And then you're pleasantly surprised in the time when you say, well, I'm not going to say no yet. I still probably will, but let's keep talking. Right. And then one out of 1,000 turns into a yes.
Yep. And, you know, some of them, I always, when you talk about venture capital or other angel, is a little bit smaller deals, obviously, but every time, and this leads right into this, and I know you're just going to roll your eyes when I start saying it, when you hear someone talking about the valuation of this unicorn company and somehow they're comparing their company in some way, shape, or form to it, I imagine that has to kind of, I don't know, just give you, I don't know what it does, but
you know,
some pause.
I understand what you're saying. But I, you know, there are so many unicorn companies that I think a lot of investors passed on that nobody thought would do anything, right? There are people that turned down Uber. There are people that turned down Amazon, right? So not everybody was so smart. They just knew, they just knew what the right companies were, right? So, you know, to me, the way I tend to approach those kinds of valuations is I tend to just sort of keep playing along the conversation until there's a showstopper. And maybe sometimes there's not a showstopper, right? And maybe because, you know, unicorns do happen, and just as though you need a skeptical eye to weed out the non-unicorns, because that's the vast majority of the universe, it's also important to keep an open mind so that when a unicorn presents itself, you can recognize it when you see it.
Yeah. So if you're looking at a company today, what would be the one thing that you would be looking for that would say, no, this isn't going to be anything?
It's
going to be challenging, I should say.
Yeah. I think it's barrier to entry. Number one, because, you know, it's especially now with the way the patents are kind of being warped with PTAB and the way that people want to challenge patents now, get sort of a second bite of the apple. you know, you got to answer the question. Well, as soon as you start to eat somebody's lunch, right? What you start to eat Alphabet's lunch, why are they not just going to throw $50 million at it internally and wipe you out? Right.
Yeah.
Because the thesis is, of course, that, well, Google's going to buy us or Alphabet's going to buy us. Like, they might, but they probably won't. You know, they do a few deals a year, right? But they only do those deals because they're forced to. They only do those deals because it's something you've got that they've decided they either can't replicate from a feasibility standpoint, or it's going to take them so long to do it, they're going to miss out on a market opportunity, right?
Yeah.
And unless you can prove to me that you've got one of those two things, then the onus is on you to prove to me that that's not going to happen.
That's a great point, you know, because I can't tell you how many people you hear that say, well, I'm going to develop and I'm going to sell it to this big company. And it's in software, it's in hard goods, all different kinds of places. You see that. But you're right. Most of them won't do it if they can do it themselves and not have to go through that hassle.
And, you know, that comes from early in my career when I sort of drank too much of that Kool-Aid. And you know, brought clients up and saw the conversations with the companies. And, you know, the client would say, you know, I want $5 million for this company. And the buyer would say, we can build it for two.
Yeah.
Right. And in fact, we think we're going to build it for five and put you out of business. So why don't you sell it to us for $400,000 because we kind of think you're a nice guy. Right? That's how those conversations go. And they're not popular. They don't get written about, but those conversations happen much more often than the big, massive exit. The big, massive exit happens because you've got overwhelming leverage.
Yeah, overwhelming leverage. Yeah, write that down. So we'll ask about that later. So as you're coming along, you're talking about business valuation. You're working on that, and you're get into risk. What really pulled you into really learning and understanding and quantifying risk in buying and selling businesses?
I think it's a market efficiency issue. And what I mean by that is value has three levers ultimately: cash flow, growth, and risk. And everybody loves to talk about cash flow. It's happy, right? You're generating a lot of cash. That's how you get on Tim Ferriss's podcast. That's how you get on Bloomberg to be interviewed, right? That's how you get on CNBC. And then growth, right? It's that times 10. You're ringing the bell at the New York Stock Exchange, right?
Yep.
But when was the last time you saw somebody on TV talking about risk, right? Who's the hero? Who's the hero that stepped in front of the bus when everybody in the company said, we got to go buy this company, but the risk person, usually the CFO, is the person who basically ties themselves to the train track and say, if we do this deal, I'm telling you, you're killing the company, right? When 20 other people want to get that deal done because that's how bonuses happen, advisors get paid more, including myself, when deals get done, okay? There are a lot of reasons that the deal is going to get done, often with somebody else's money. Right. I think about those people, and I've worked with them enough saying, you know, those people need an ally. Those people need somebody that speaks the language of risk and where people like that in the organization get shouted down is that risk is something that's historically very hard to quantify. So the poor CFO is often left with a very qualitative discussion, which is not where the CFO wants to be, because the CFO is usually a numbers person, right?
Yep.
So you're taking a person who speaks English and you're asking them to deliver their argument in French.
And yes.
That is difficult, right?
Yeah.
And think about, you know, but think about how many bad deals would have been averted when somebody listened to that one guy or that one woman in the company that was right. Right? Think about how economic history would have been rewritten had somebody, anybody, listened to the people talking about the fact that the housing market itself was unstable, but it was unstable on steroids because it was so highly leveraged using instruments that even public company auditors didn't understand because they couldn't do the math.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? And I just think people like that need an ally. People like that need a champion.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. Well, I want to say real quick, I apologize because I didn't have it flipped over to see the comments, but we got Dale giving us the strong arm. Good. Glad to see you here again, Dale. Dale Aikens, the guy I know well. Then we have Dean. Dean is, he hit some things earlier. This is compared to a $6 trillion industry, this is a deal. I don't know where that in the conversation. I apologize. We weren't keeping up with it because I was listening to Mike and enthralled by it. But, oh, he had a spelling save. But anyway, when he was talking about buying the big companies buying them, and it's just such a great conversation. But thanks for being here, Dean. Thanks, Dale, for being here. When you talk about that, that is really a great point because, you know, that is the CFO can – intuitively feel it. They may have some indicators to do it to really, though, be able to quantify what it is. They are walking out into unknown territory for them, and it's got to be very hard to justify what they're saying and for others to even take it any way seriously because they're used to them coming to them with numbers.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's why, you know, I think that finance in general and my industry in particular, in business valuation, has to adopt more widely risk management and risk specification tools. And they're out there, but because they're kind of mathy, they're often ignored and they're very easily dismissed as well. There are Greek letters in here, and so this is just pointy-headed academic stuff. But, you know, pointy-headed academic, a lot of pointy-headed academics have actually made a lot of money on that stuff.
Yeah.
So you might want to listen to them sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You're right, because it's not simple, but it is applicable. And yeah, sometimes we overlook it.
Yeah. That's right. And it's, you know, it's going to take you a little bit to work the numbers out. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, Monte Carlo simulation. For me, it's not hard because I've been doing it for 15 years, right? But for others, it can be challenging. But I can tell you, when I run those simulations in real time, and I can show the visuals of the outcomes that are being drawn in real time, it brings a sense of wonder to the client, which in finance you don't often have the opportunity to do. But when, mm-hmm, when you show that there's a way to illustrate quantitatively that, you know, there's a 5% chance that if you do this deal, it's going to kill your company, right? And here's the numbers to support it, right? You know, you can still do that deal. If you're comfortable with a 5% risk of killing your company, go for it. And I'm not going to tell you to take the risk or not take the risk, but at a minimum, don't go into the deal not knowing what the risk looks like.
Yeah,
that's malpractice.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point because, you know, there's risk to be comfortable with, but ignoring the risk and not knowing what the risk is, I mean, it can kill you. It just can kill your business really easily if you don't understand it well enough. So tell me about some situations where you've gone in and something looks good on the outside, but you start digging in and you start doing your thing and you go, oh, this is not quite as pretty as it looks like on the outside. We just got the Carfax, maybe.
Yeah. So my favorite is actually one of my first simulation assignments where a client that has been a client of mine for a long time. They're about to sell their company for nine figures. But I've helped them do a number of acquisitions and they asked me to help them evaluate a potential acquisition. And, you know, I did what I did. I said, here's what I think the value of the company is, and here's why, here's the narrative. And the client looked, you know, the client sort of paused and said, you know, this is great, and I'm sure you're right. What I really care about is, if I buy this thing, I don't want to have to put more than $3 million into this company in the next 5 years, right? Whatever the price is, that's my appetite for potentially covering losses of the company. What is the likelihood that I'm going to have to do that?
Oh, yeah.
And I said, okay, well, that's a concept called value at risk that is not, again, one of those things that is often relegated to pointy-headed academia. Mm-hmm. Right. But it's a real thing. And it involves a little bit of math, not a ton, a little bit of statistics. And within a couple of weeks, I could put together a model. I said, look, if my model is accurate, if it's correctly specified, there's a 30% chance you're going to have to put in at least that much money in the next 5 years or more. And the client walked away from the deal. I said, look, the price may be right, but that's not a risk tolerance that I'm not a risk tolerance that I care about.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that point that I discovered, you know, price is important, but quantifying risk and specifying it is so powerful. It instantly made my client a much better decision maker.
Mm-hmm.
It was that assignment all those years ago that led me to, you know, that led me to understand risk is where it's at. Risk is where you find either the underpriced opportunities or the overpriced opportunities. And because the world is conditioned to think about risk purely in qualitative terms, for those of us who can think about risk in a quantitative way, that gives us a lot of information that others don't have, and information is value.
Yes. I'm sitting here thinking about what you just said, and it is certainly, we should pause and think about that a little bit. And if someone's listening to this now, that is anything to do with buying and selling businesses, you just said something that was, it was pretty, you know, it really rang a bell for me. Is you're looking at that company, helping your client do that, and they want to know, hey, what's the chance I'm going to put $3 million in over the next X years? And you're telling them, hey, this is a chance, and it's too high. They walk away from it. But you then said, spotting an undervalued or overvalued company because of the quantifying the risk is a huge thing. Because if you went in and you did the same thing and you had three different companies you were going to buy, you could do it. Okay, what is the chances that I'm going to have to invest in this company and this company and this company, or the return I can get? And you just, they could be the same price. It could be looked the same on the outside, same cash flow, everything else. But the other things that you put together could show that one of those companies is significantly better than the other two.
Yeah, that's right. And what it made me realize again is that value has a limitation in terms of its informative value. It's important, but it's not nearly as all encompassing, right?
Yeah.
And again, it goes back to there's so much focus on growth and cash flow, which are important, but because those are so heavily scrutinized, there's not a lot of things new to learn there. Mm-hmm. What isn't as heavily scrutinized because many people lack the tools to do so is the risk part of the equation.
Yeah.
And so if I've got a pair of binoculars and the other guy just has the naked eye, right, I'm going to see a lot more birds I can bag. It's really that simple.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And you're going to walk away from the ones that aren't going to be the right birds. I mean,
exactly.
People are just shooting them in it, you know, blindly, and you're just shooting the ones you want. That's the thing. And so it goes down a whole different thing. So how widely, when you look at is there a certain size where you really see a size of transaction when you really see people starting to go into the risk, taking the plunge into it. So if I'm going to be buying a $100 million company, is that where you go? Oh, at standard practice? Or if you go $10 million standard practice, is there really, do you see that some of these groups that are doing these transactions, just a standard practice that they're always going to do, or is it still kind of one-offish because they haven't pulled, like you said, the pointy academics into there to really give them that background?
I think it varies company to company. If a company has a defined strategy of making acquisitions or something strategic like that, then they're going to have processes, especially if they're working with a private equity fund. Because private equity funds do pay, of course, a lot of attention to risk, but many of them, again, surprisingly, don't use a lot of the quantitative tools available to them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because if it's like, is it so common you go, oh yeah, it's like, it's, you know, whatever, but you're saying that there's still a lot of deals done that are sizable deals without it.
In my experience, yes. I mean, you know, and I don't have a comprehensive view of every deal on the planet. But my experience is, and my visibility says that risk assessment, generally speaking, is a very qualitative approach, and there's what I call sort of a false quant approach when people will do what's called a sensitivity analysis, right? And this sort of thing drives me crazy because it's such a waste of time. But you know, they'll perform their own analysis and valuation of the company, and they'll say, well, our cost of capital is actually +1% or -1%. Here's how the value of the company is impacted. Or if the terminal growth rate is +1%, -1%, here's how the value is impacted, right? And it's to give the illusion that you're accounting for risk when you're not. In most of those cases, the analyst is picking a random range. Right.
Yes.
Which may as well be putting on a blindfold while shooting an arrow at an archery target 50 yards away.
Yeah. I mean,
if you don't know the distribution of those potential outcomes, if you don't know where the mean truly is, if you don't know what the standard deviation is, then those sensitivity analyses are meaningless. And they're so dangerous because many people are led into thinking they're meaningful simply because it exists. And they think that they're covered, right? And then they make terrible decisions because, again, they don't know what they don't know. They don't even know how to ask the questions that define whether or not the parameters of the sensitivity analysis are relevant.
Yeah, because as you're saying, quantitative risk is just not discussed very often in acquisitions or transactions. It's just not discussed very often at all.
It's not. It's left to the quant jocks working for hedge funds and for option traders, that sort of thing, right? Risk is their business.
Yes.
So, you know, they discuss it, but in terms of the M&A world, you know, you just, at least I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it done in a systematic, rigorous way. I'm sure it is done. Like the Fortune 500, there's nothing that I can teach them, right? They're not calling me for a good reason. They already know everything I know and more.
Yeah.
But the impact I can make is somebody that's at $100 million business.
Yeah.
Right? And they don't necessarily have those tools. They haven't been exposed to it. And just simply putting that tool in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as you look at this and some of the clients that you've been working with, you mentioned one working with over the years, do they begin to incorporate looking at risk in normal business decisions and having you go through some of those things? Or is that really more for just in the buying and selling of business?
So they start to. What happens with those first couple of projects where I help clients with their risk profiling is they start to learn the language of risk. Okay. They start to understand things like a standard normal distribution and a mean and a standard deviation. Okay. And a discrete versus continuous variable. They start to pick up that language and they start to say, huh, I wonder if we could do that with our sales forecasts. I wonder if we could do that with our supply chain risk. I wonder if we could do that as we assess whether or not we have the right amount and kind of insurance. And that's the beauty of these risk analysis tools. You're familiar with the term of platform technology. Mm-hmm. Risk analysis is a platform concept that once you learn the basics, you start to, your eyes open up and you just start to see, oh man, we can apply this to every part of our business and we become risk forward. Mm-hmm. And here's the dirty little secret. You know, if I move my cash flow or my growth up a percentage point, that's 1/10 the impact of decreasing my risk that same percentage point.
Explain that again.
Think about the value equation. Cash flow times growth in the numerator, and then risk is in the denominator. Mm-hmm. Right? What happens when you decrease your risk? It has that multiplier effect.
Oh, yeah. I have to put the formula on a piece of paper here so I can look at it, but you're right.
You think about your valuation multiple, right? EBITDA over K minus G.
Yeah.
Right? K is your risk variable. You change that a little bit, and all of a sudden your multiple just explodes.
Yeah. Yeah. So how many people come to you talking about that? Because if I'm sitting here today and I'm looking at doing a large transaction in the next few years, how many come to you and go, okay, let's do a risk analysis today so we can go tomorrow. We've really made a difference in that.
Well, the ones that have worked with me, once they have that, they're recidivists. They come back again and again. Okay.
Yeah.
The ones that don't sort of, they found me through social media or somebody's referred them and they say, you're the risk guy, right? You're the risk wizard. And the person, I don't understand exactly how it is that you do what you do, but I want to have a conversation kind of like this. Mm-hmm. How do you think about risk? How can we make risk a risk management a competitive advantage for our firm?
Yeah.
And we'll have a conversation like this. And some people are scared and they run screaming, and that's fine. But then other people say, yeah, you know, this makes sense. This is a concept I've had, but I haven't had the vocabulary to express it. And you've given me the vocabulary to have these conversations and make these concepts applicable in a real world business context. And then we go from there.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you were thinking about this ahead of time and it's going to affect it greatly, this could be, and when you look at people that are investing in businesses to build them, to grow their value, or people that are doing that and they're nearing an exit, that risk can be huge because you look at why don't businesses sell? Well, they don't sell because, you know, customer concentration, or they're going to have all these other problems that are going to, in the kind of things. And that risk can be changed. And if that risk is changed, it drastically affects the marketability.
Well, and the beauty of it, again, the other dirty little secret is risk is the easiest thing to change about your company, right? You've worked with, how many companies you worked with over the decades, and they're trying to figure out how to move the needle on their sales and their mm-hmm. cash flow. And a good salesperson is really hard to find.
Right? Yep.
And saying, you know, it's one thing to say, I want to increase my sales growth from 4 to 7%. But you know this, I mean, companies crawl naked over broken glass, the sensitive side down, trying to get that growth number because sales is such an inexact practice.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. But on the other hand, risk, take customer concentration. It's not that hard to diversify customer concentration. Go get another customer.
Yeah.
Go tell your salespeople that that I'm not going to give you commission anymore for customers you already have, or I'm going to lower your commission. You want to make the big bonus, you got to get new customers coming in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to buy another company that's got a customer concentration issue in the same industry. I'm going to convince them they got to sell to me for less because they've got the big, scary customer concentration issue. But by buying them, now I've got two customers accounting for 80% of sales instead of one, and there's an arbitrage opportunity.
Yeah.
That happens all the time.
Yeah, I never even thought of that. But the risk, the change in risk, just because you put those two together like that. And, you know, it's very interesting. We've seen and you mentioned one of the things is if when listeners here, you may think about this, you may scoff at this, but I'm going to tell you one of the things I think is a real opportunity for business owners right now that are in the situation that you talked about is doing this, is combining with someone else that, hey, could be a friendly competitor, could be somebody across the country that you know, because you just absolutely transformed your chances of exiting that business successfully for more money. It is without a doubt, you just made some things happen. And that's such a great point. I'm just sitting here flabbergasted at that, because that could help you immensely. So as you're going along, sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but no, as you're going along now, everybody's talking about AI. Yeah. Everybody's talking about AI and this and that. In risk, are you seeing things where it's actually helping that, or is AI really still the text base, not doing the calculations kind of stuff and helping make better decisions there? Or do you see it really starting to be, because correct me if I'm wrong, but risk is really blending a lot of different factors together, right? Mm-hmm. That's what you're trying to do. So is the AI helpful in seeing things that we wouldn't as humans, or haven't really seen it been developed yet?
So right now, I think AI is in set, the AI we're used to, and we got to be careful, because for people like me, who's, you know, I'm not a computer programmer.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, AI showed up when ChatGPT was made available. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, I understand chatbots, all that stuff, right? But in terms of something that I actually use, right, it's, you know, AI started that day that it was made available to me.
Yeah.
But we know that there's been some kind of it, that AI has been a thing really since the mid 1990s. It just hasn't been transparent to us.
Yeah.
Now AI is like a fire hose that's turned on full blast. And nobody's holding the end.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So you tell me, right? Sometimes that fire hose is going to get pointed at the fire, right? And sometimes you're going to point at a chihuahua across the street and knock his head off. And I don't know which one it is. And
100%.
I think for a lot of companies, they don't know what that is yet.
I was just curious if you had seen something where it really did anything yet, but that's over time. Yeah, I think we can do it. But I was just wondering, because the interesting thing about it doesn't forget, it can consider more variables than we can and those kind of things. But if your risk analysis is already doing that appropriately, it may not be anything. And I was just curious, because there's so much being said about it. But
where I found AI to be helpful, and from my perspective, is it does help make sure it does give you another source of questions to ask. Right? I can type into ChatGPT, here's the basic fact pattern of the business, right? What questions should I be asking? And I do that three times. And the questions that come up all three times, the ones I'm going to ask.
Oh,
the ones that are outliers, I tend to discard.
Yeah. That's an interesting way to use it. And that's very cool. That's very cool. So as you are helping businesses do this, and as you see things coming along, is this risk analysis becoming more common?
No, I don't think that it is. I'm still, I still wish it were more common, but we have a collectively have a very short memory of when things go bad on us, right? I mean, how many times do we have to lend money to Argentina before you just sort of figure out they always default? Now, with all due respect to the new president, and I know nothing about him, but I guess he's sort of shaking things up. Right, but how many times in our lifetime have they defaulted? Three, four, right? It
Still
just
gonna happen
surprises me
again,
when
yeah.
they don't default, right? That's the real headline. So,
Yeah.
I think that. So what my observation is that we have a 10-year pendulum, and
Yep.
this is from my 53 years on the planet. We have 2 years when we start to really care about risk. And we're emerging from that over the last 2 years. Okay. But up until then, the prior 8 years, it's punch bowl time. It's party
Yeah,
time. Right.
it's drinking as
It's
fast as
all
you
about
can.
growth and cash flow. And anybody who's talking about risk is, why do you got to be like that? Right. Why do you got to be that guy? And that's when the whole world is set, the whole world wants a growth stock, and everybody's writing the articles that Warren Buffett has lost his touch and he doesn't know what he's talking about, right? And then there's a market correction, and suddenly price to book is in fashion, and Warren Buffett is back to being the Oracle of Omaha. And we're coming out of that, and it's gonna go back to growth and cash flow again, and nobody's gonna care about risk. Right. But for me, that's great because that's where the when nobody's looking at risk, that's when you can make money on
Very cool. So interesting talking to you, Mike, and learning more about, your take and hearing you talk about risk. I mean, just back from talking about your examples of looking at the company and looking at the for helping your client where they were going to buy a company, but they didn't want to put more than $3 million in over the next few years. And you're able to say that and they walk away from it. And then we talk about, wow, that's a quite a different way to evaluate your acquisition targets or if your company was a good sale candidate right now, to really understand that risk to see if you're if where you want to buy at is undervalued or overvalued. And then really how if you understood risk, this is a thing that I is, think that hopefully people listening today really take to heart to understand the risk and sales projections and your supply chain and whatever else you want to think about in your business because understanding that and making a change to those the risk factors could be a huge thing for you. I mean, if you're a company and you're making something like heart valves or your risk moving your risk factor down can make a big difference over time. And
Well, you think Boeing stock might do a little bit better if they did different risk modeling on their fuselage design and construction, right? I mean,
Yes.
that 737 MAX. I mean, if Boeing doesn't put a bullet in that, I don't understand what they're waiting for, because that thing has been a disaster since the day the thing rolled off the assembly line. And it's fascinating to watch Boeing how they're trying to address risk, right? And we'll that story has yet to be written, but Boeing is an ongoing case study that's going to launch about 58 different dissertations in risk assessment and management right now.
Yes. I agree with you 100% there, and it's a great example of high cost to misjudging risk, and then just the aftermath of that is just mind-boggling in the cost and downstream effects and just things you don't know, so. So when you're thinking about risk, though, we're getting close to time here, but I want to ask you one last question. Now, when we talk about risk, we talk about how you're calculating risk, and we're talking about math that's been around a long time, the statistical stuff. What's new in risk that you're going, wow, this is kind of cool. I'm really, this has got me kind of excited about it again.
Let me answer it this way. What I'm thinking about that is new to me in terms of risk is game theory. Business valuation assumes, generally speaking, an equilibrium between buyer and sellers, mm-hmm. having a utility function that meets up. And what that means in English is that buyers and sellers have an equal motivation to be in the deal or not in the deal, right? Which is fantastic, with the sole exception that never happens in real life.
Yeah.
Right. There's always a disequilibrium in leverage. And sometimes you can overcome that with deal structure. You can overcome that with superior negotiation. Right. But the fact of the matter is that equilibrium happens on average. If you average every deal, sure. But on a micro level, there's always disequilibrium. And mm-hmm. so I'm kind of playing around with game theory as a way of quantifying the relative leverage as a risk differential, or as a function of risk differential between buyers and sellers, among other things.
That is really cool. Oh, that's awesome, man. That's awesome. I could see from your perspective, I know other people might be listening, they don't understand it, but man, just understanding some of these things, right, has got to be really exciting to you. Because if it could bring to new discoveries, you could help to develop better solutions for your clients and ultimately help them build and buy more valuable businesses.
Yeah, again, it's new tools. The exciting thing for clients is that the market for knowledge in this area is not efficient, which means there are opportunities for arbitrage all over the place. Because game theory involves fairly basic calculus, like calculus two, maybe, a lot of people just sort of run screaming and the easy way out is, well, it's just academic stuff, right? That academic stuff that, you know, Nash won a Nobel Prize for a reason, right? Mm-hmm. That must be somewhat valid, right? So yeah. It's just a matter of trying to take that and again, equipping clients, and not just clients. I want to equip everybody with the vocabulary to ask the right questions about risk.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Oh, so interesting, Mike. I've really appreciate you taking the time and talking about risk with us today and you know, just how risk really affects the value of business, how it affects decision making in the buying and selling of businesses, and the other things you've shared today. So if someone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
So I'm not hard to find. On my handle it says Unblakeable, so you can use that as a handle to find me on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. I'm posting there almost every day.
Nice.
If you want to go email, it's mblake@highscorestrategies.com. So I'm not hard to find.
All right, Mike. Well, thanks so much for being here. And I want to thank all the listeners today for being there and the people that were commenting, Deo and Dean and others. Thank you. Mike, thanks for being here today, and hang out for a minute. We'll talk after we're done here.
Yeah. Thanks so much. This is so much fun.
Oh, man, good stuff.